who said that. Oh, okay, Sandy, good.
It's Bob Meyer.
Yeah, he's here.
Are we at good?
Yep.
Okay. Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Members, we have a couple of updates from the DNR. What do we call it? The redo budget? The supplemental budget report and some results budget outcomes information that we've been asking from the DNR will be presented. So we'll have a brief presentation from the DNR on those updates and then some bills. So we have a long agenda. Welcome, Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the record. Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, and I will do the best I can to keep you on track and be as brief as possible. I just wanted to make sure that I brought to your attention the document that we discussed when we did our FY 10 and 11 budget presentations to you all. It is a finished document now. It's entitled Budgeting for Results, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources FY 10 and 11 Biennial Budget Request. This is available on the DNR website as well as with all of our legislative presentations. And it is our first take at what we're looking at, performance-based measurement, performance budgeting, and outcomes. So it will be a work in progress as we move forward, not only this session, but throughout the biennium and biennium to come with hope. You can see the first page is just a table of contents with a diagram really looking at describing how we've developed our budget this session, looking at the three major trends and then the three pressure points that we see coming at us on those trends: landscape changes, recreation participation changes, and energy and climate changes. If you go to page 2, there's just some narrative about how we've developed this document, taking budget development and using it, pulling it into budget implementation. Page 3 really outlines the mission, our agency goals, and those driving trends and the strategies that we're using to address those trends, which are very helpful as we look at preparing for the next biennial budget, talking about how those trends, outdoor recreation participation changes, for example, the strategies we're going to use to address those trends include increased outdoor recreation participation through targeted marketing and communications and outreach, the promotion of DNR lands as gateways to the outdoors by ensuring high-quality, easy-to-access, safe recreational opportunities, especially for families and new participants. And you can see that those other two trends, renewable energy and climate change, and landscape changes from growth and development, are outlined and described that way as well. Basically, looking at the strategies that are our change items within this biennial budget request. If you move to page 4, Madam Chair and members, this is the meat of this document here. And I'll just walk through the way it's set up, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time diving into this, but as we move forward, if the committee wants to spend more time on this, we certainly can. You'll see on the first column on the left is the strategic objectives, or our division building blocks that we presented to you in our budget, and these are also the building blocks that we use to build our budget. The next column talks about the total, and for this one, Madam Chair, it excludes PILS for lands and minerals. The PILT total is on the far right-hand side with the governor's record, $35 million. These numbers are for FY 10 and 11 as well, so we have to remember it's not 5 fiscal years for the total biennium, which is important to remember. And then you can see going down that second column, we're talking about what the percentage of the total budget would be off of the total. And then we put in there what the actual general fund portion of that budget was for last biennium. As we go through and load our budgets up, we take what the legislature has passed and implemented into law. Then we go through and we build our budgets off of that, looking at all the funds that are there and taking general fund and other dedicated accounts into consideration, as we load our budgets for the coming biennium. So these are the actual numbers that we spent in 08-09 these activities, and we wanted to give you an idea of what the general fund portion of those total amounts were for each activity. So, for example, for minerals management, it represents about 30% of the fiscal year 10 and 11 operating budget for the Division of Lands and Minerals, or roughly $6.2 million. Last biennium of that amount, the budgeted expenditures total was $8 million, roughly, with a general fund total of only $669,000. And you can see that does include special revenue, only a portion of which was in the operating budget. So this really does contain a lot of information, members, on each building block of the DNR budget. You can go through, for example, if you look at real estate management, the third block down, it represents about 49% of the lands and minerals fiscal year 10 and 11 operating budget for the division, roughly $10.2 million. Last biennium, the budgeted total, which didn't include PILT either, was $11.5 million, of which $8.5 was general fund dollars. So we're trying to identify a couple things here in this column, what the actual expenditure was as a percentage last fiscal year, including general fund broken out, and also what we're estimating of the total appropriation this activity would be for the coming biennium. And then as you go to the right, you can see example indicators and change item targets. The change items are included in on your copy, Madam Chair members. It's yellow. On the black and white copies, they're just shaded out cells. But for example, staying within real estate management, you can see that was one area that had a general fund reduction of $1.35 million. And part of that reduction was to fully recover the costs for processing contracts for utility licenses and easements, reduce or eliminate various real estate services, including trail sales, transfers of custodial control, and resolution of trespasses. And then in the far column, you'll see the outcome description. We manage about 12,500 real estate contracts for various purposes each year, and these include the easements and utility licenses. It gives you more information about the types of services that we provide there. As you move through each page, the next section is waters. That talks about the change items there, the funding breakouts, and what we have. The next section after that is forestry, for example. If you look to page 7, Madam Chair and members, we outline the forest management investment account on allotments or reductions here in the change items there and what those impacts are going to be. Talking about the unallotted amount from the natural resources account in 08-09 in addition to that. So it really does contain all of the information that is in, if you want to think about it, the biennial budget system, the change item documents that are within the governor's budget in a tabular format, trying to tie it to the best we can right now with some, though they are generic in some areas, some kind of outcomes and performance targets so people can understand what it is they are getting for a specific dollar amount or the impacts of a specific reduction in the case of a change item that does have a reduction attached to it, Madam Chair.
All right, Mr. Meyer, thank you. I think these sheets are really helpful, and I've gotten some of them from some of these and some PCA and Bowser ones, and I've been scouring them over the last few weekends, and the members, I would encourage you to read them carefully because there is a lot more information than we've gotten in our overall budget reviews. I still have a few questions. I mean, it's helpful to have – we're talking a lot more clearly about the results that we're getting for our dollars in this format, so it's really good. In some cases, I'd like to see the possible, I would really like to see the breakdown of personnel costs in these categories. And I know I saw that in one of the budget documents. I think maybe it was a PCA one that was similar. But it was, because when you're talking about these large dollar amounts, it's really hard to get your head around where all the money goes. And, you know, for example, I'll just pull out an example. Under real estate management, $10 million. Am I reading that right? Or budgeted expenditures, $11 million last biennium, and $10 million this biennium. How much of that is personnel? How much of that, you know, just to sort of break it down would be more helpful because that's a big chunk of money, and it's hard to get a handle on what proportion of the money is used for staffing compared to other embedded costs that you have. So that would be a helpful addition.
Madam Chair, we will do the best we can. In certain areas, there will be that the personnel complement are going to cross over different programmatic activities because of the multiple activities and multiple benefits that ecological resources, fish and wildlife, for example, they do a variety of things. Our forestry personnel as well, they're cruising timber, they're fighting fire, things like that. But we can certainly break out FTEs and try to address those concerns that you have at some level, as clear as we can as possible. We'll work with fiscal staff to develop some common format to do that.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the documents? All right. Senator Fredrickson.
Unfortunately, because of committee conflicts, I missed a couple meetings of this committee, and I'd like to ask about a specific program. If I may.
That's fine.
Madam Chair, Mr. Meyer, what's happening with the emerald ash borer threat to Minnesota? Is that going forward as we've talked about the last couple of years, or has the department done any new initiatives with emerald ash borer, and how imminent is that threat?
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, the threat from the emerald ash borer is still progressing towards us. It is identified in Wisconsin. I believe Eau Claire was the closest last I heard, but we can get back to you on that. There is a proposal within the Forestry Division's budget that will help us deal with some of those plans. If you look on page 8 here under Forest Health, this is going to allow for heritage enhancement dollars of $950,000 each year to be provided to the Department of Natural Resources to help us continue surveys on state forest lands for invasives, develop and implement management guidelines for the control of invasive species such as emerald ash borer. So I would love to be able to say we're going to prevent it from coming here, but that's just not the trend that's out there right now. So we also have to provide assistance to people on how to manage it, but we have to try to prepare ourselves for what happens when it does get here as well. And we're working with the Department of Agriculture and other local units of government, the Forestry Service, and things like that to deal with that. And the invasive species are a critical threat to our forest ecosystem health.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Senator Pariseau.
Madam Chair, to follow up on Senator Fredrickson's question, how is the count coming? I mean, I know they've got traps out. Is there any, are they establishing any kind of progress figures or not? Or are they not at that point yet?
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Pariseau, the traps that we have, we're working with the Department of Ag for the gypsy moth right now. Emerald ash borer is more of a monitoring phase, watching where it's coming in and trying to make sure, working with the Department of Ag, continue inspections of timber products and wood products that are coming into the state, making sure that people are aware of what's going on and things like that. The law we passed 2 years ago highlighting or prohibiting people bringing firewood into the state of Minnesota was very, very helpful in raising the awareness of that issue. And it's been extremely effective. It's been great. We saw a little bit of resistance in the beginning, but people are so concerned and aware of it now. It'll really help us on the identification and management if it does get here. So,
thank you.
Madam Chair, if there are no other questions, I'd like to briefly go to several of the items that are in the governor's supplemental budget. Mm-hmm. And I think the committee has a sheet.
Yeah, we do.
Provided by committee staff. It says March 2009 governor's revised recommendations. There are several things in the supplemental budget that do impact the Department of Natural Resources. The first one I'm going to discuss is the land sales extension. And actually, the language that is in here is incorrect, Madam Chair. There will be new language coming that will be distributed. I'm not sure. I would assume it will be in a bill format. But the bill will extend the land sales deadline from 2009 to 2011. But there also, the budget will be recommending or be tracking $2 million worth of sales in 2009. $2 million in 10 to meet that goal. And it's my understanding that language will also clarify that if that goal is not met, $2 million each of those fiscal years will be unallotted from the Department of Natural Resources budget. So I wish I had that language to provide you right now, but it's my understanding that that's what the language is at this point in time. There's also an appropriation for the lottery in lieu dollars that are there, an increase, which would provide $425 each year from the Natural Resources Fund to the Division of Parks and Trails. Of this amount, we will use $375,000 each year to partner with Explore Minnesota Tourism to and promote our parks and trail system and gain new visitors and usership within the system. It's one that we thought about doing for a long time, and after talking with them for a long time on events like the Fishing Opener and Deer Hunters Opener, they really have the expertise and the networking and the tools available to help us leverage the state park system with other tourism-type aspects that are out there throughout the state and other resorts, campgrounds, and things like that. So it's taking our parks system and promoting it with all of the outdoor, other outdoor recreation that Explore Minnesota Tourism does.
So, Mr. Meyer, what do they promote the parks now? Explore Minnesota, isn't that state funded?
They promote some of this. They do a little bit of parks advertisement. Most of it is at pro bono or very limited resources from us. This will greatly enhance. So, kind of put what we're getting from them on steroids, so to speak, and we'll have a lot more advertisement, a lot more visibility throughout the state of Minnesota and outstate, because they do a lot of marketing in areas such as Chicago, Wisconsin. The outstate marketing that they do is a lot greater than any that we do at all.
Is Mr. Nelson here? I'm wondering. I was surfing last night the state parks website. Yeah, I know I'm a geek, but it's kind of I'm just looking for places to go this summer, and it was really hard to figure out. I mean, I was just trying to find what state parks have nice swimming beaches and good kayaking opportunities, and it's really hard to figure that out on the website. I mean, you can go to park by park by park, or you can go to this little tiny chart that has like dots for each facility, but it doesn't give you any information about, you know, you don't have a picture of a beach or know where if you're kayaking in the same place you're swimming. I mean, it's just very, very limited information, and it did make me think about if you're booking a resort on a lot of travel kinds of websites, you can get so much information so easily these days about hotels and resorts and other places to visit, and it would be nice to have that level of really easily visual and accessible information for the public to see what we have so many state parks, and we should have photos of what they look like on the websites. We don't even really have, I mean, there's a very few.
Madam Chair, this appropriation would allow greatly enhanced promotional opportunities, and I will go back and we'll review with our Parks and Trails staff on how that website is operating and see what we can do to
Well, not for me, but it's just Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's interesting. This is coming up today. I've been trying to figure out if we can set up a time for the Parks and Trails subcommittee to meet on next Friday on this issue, because not only this concern has been brought to my attention by several families that are dealing with the same situation, but in general, the system itself is not connected. And so the problem that you have as a family member, as a parent trying to figure out what to do, extends to organizations and individuals who are interested in the system and trying to figure out, you know, if trails are actually connected, if they connect to park, mm-hmm. what is the state going to do to establish a priority to fund these parks or trails, and why? We don't have a statewide system that is connected. And so on Friday, I'm hoping that we could have a hearing to talk about how the metropolitan area does this, and then how DNR does this, and how the University of Minnesota actually is doing a tremendous job in terms of mapping out. Madam Chair, if I may, I'm curious about this, because this is significant money. Out of $425,000, $375,000 will be used to promote parks. Am I reading this correctly? So that's almost the entire budget will be going entirely to promote parks?
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Rae, no, this is an increase. This number here does not show the total appropriation. This is just an increase in the lottery and lieu dollars. And while Mr. Mueller is looking up that number, I just wanted to comment on your comments about the interconnectedness, because that is the exact reason why we've combined the Parks and Trails divisions, to make sure that we have the interconnectedness, make sure that we have the vision in working with the trails and the parks, and that they are connected as they are. Recreation-based systems that people want to use. They want to get from one park to another by trails and things like that. And I hope that it's part of the legislature's and all of our stakeholders' vision is to come up with a plan. And you should be able to go from Zippo Bay to down in Pipestone County or to any park that we go from. You should be able to have a connected trail system throughout the state right now. And we're trying to do that, but there's really not a lot of interconnectedness at the current time. So we appreciate your concerns, and we look forward to working with you.
And I do think that it would pay off to provide that information to the public. I think it will really pay off in usage, that people will use it more if they can figure that out more easily. Senator Saxhug.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think you and Senator Torres-Rae have something here, you know, in terms of what we were talking about, Senator, and projects of significance. How can we spend millions of dollars off this amendment on improving our state parks and then you hit on the big piece. You've got to have people. We've got to compete with private and the federal government and everybody else. I think we really need to invest in that.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, it sounds like there's a lot of interest in this. We might like to maybe Senator Torres-Rae in your subcommittee, or maybe at another time we could bring in Mr. Nelson or somebody who could just give us a little bit more information about this proposal and how that advertising plan would, that promotion plan, what that would really look like. But why don't you go ahead then, please.
Madam Chair, members, the other two items on this sheet, the Parks and Trails grants and the Parks and Trails legacy, you can just see that there's a decrease in the out years 12 and 13. This is just to bring this in line with the forecasting recommendations that the budget has now for the out years for these two funds. They have somewhat just based upon the fiscal integrity that the forecasting that has been done. So it recommends decreasing those total appropriations that were out in the original forecast.
Mr. Mayor, sorry, I was
two pieces that we have. So.
Okay, is there any further questions? Okay. The EQB transfer to the PCA. Talk about why do you want to do that? Oh no, this is the PCA. Sorry, wrong person. Sorry about that. I'm like on the bottom of the sheet. That's not your sheet. If you have an opinion, feel free to express it.
Madam Chair, I'll defer to the PCA on that one.
Sorry about that. Okay, I'm awake now. All right. Any further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Meyer, for the update. Okay, we have on the agenda. Senator Spogan, did I see him here? I think members will let non-committee members go ahead and take their bills first. So, Senator Spogan, why don't you go ahead? If you're ready and you have everyone here.
I'm sure Senator Rosen isn't here yet, so you can jump in and let's go wait.
Okay, that's fine. We'll wait until she arrives. And Senator Chaudhry, are you ready to go?
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an amendment to offer, but I'll, while that's being passed out, I'll explain the bill. This passed the policy committee unanimously after a lot of really good discussion on where we're going with our land policies. And then we had an excellent discussion on the same topic, actually, yesterday in relation to our land sales bill, which is not related to this. What this bill does is correct a session law from 2005 that required the sale of Minnesota owned lands, state lands, to be put into the general fund in the amount of a total amount of $6 million. It was a law that was passed in 2005 to solve some budget issues. And since then, it has come to light that the burden of these land sales has fallen on the DNR. And on top of that, the burden has fallen on a lot of recreational lands that Minnesota owns. In many cases, not all, but many cases, these are parcels that are supported by the communities. Not always, but sometimes. And it just appears to be a policy that was passed without a lot of knowledge and not a lot of vetting, actually very little vetting, in 2005 and has created onerous results. This bill does not prohibit the sale of Minnesota lands. It does not prohibit the reaching of this $6 million budget target. All of those things are preserved in this bill. All it says is that the lands that are sold by the state of Minnesota cannot fall under the definition of the outdoor recreation statute. That brings into the lands that we are most concerned about being sold to solve a general fund budget from 2005. So WMAs, scientific natural areas, parks, even state forests are the four largest examples. Again, this does not prohibit the sales of those lands. Sometimes it is appropriate. But when those lands are sold, the proceeds go usually go into a land acquisition account for the purpose of purchasing similar land. This, however, would prohibit those proceeds to go into the general fund. The reason why we want this bill, the biggest reason we want this bill, is to prevent the chilling effect on the future public-private partnerships that so often go into the purchase of these types of parcels. Conservation groups, federal authorities, all of local communities, a lot of effort oftentimes goes into the purchasing or the protection of these types of lands, scientific natural area, wildlife management area, and the like. And so it would be very, it would have a chilling effect on these. The most important thing is that it would have a chilling effect on these types of efforts if people were to know that somehow the state, despite all their efforts, could just go ahead and sell that property for the purposes of solving a budget deficit. I don't think that's the policy that we want in this state. The policy committee agreed. And so we are, so we're proposing that we don't prohibit us reaching this $6 million target. We've already got about $2 million of it reached already. It doesn't prohibit land sales. It just says that if that no sale could go to the general fund, it must stay the course and either go into a land acquisition account or the DNR's facilities account, which purchases additional buildings and lands for their operations, or the school trust fund. I mean, the last thing we would want is a school trust fund land to be put into the general fund, the proceeds of which going into the general fund. Not good policy. So that's what my bill does. It simply carves out this statute, the lands that we are most concerned about that fall under the outdoor recreation statute. Those lands cannot be sold for the purposes of putting in the proceeds into the general fund. The governor's supplemental budget has included an extension of this sale. The deadline, by the way, they have to reach this goal by this year. I think it's June 30th of this year. That's why this has kind of come to a head. It was delayed last year, or 2007, but now it's coming to a head this year. And the governor has proposed another delay to 2011, which is fine with me. But whether it's now or 2011, I don't think this category of land should be sold for the purposes of putting the money into the general fund. So the amendment that I have adds to the bill the extension for 2011 for all Minnesota land sales. All Minnesota land sales. But it still retains the prohibition on the lands within the outdoor rec account, which now or later I don't think we should ever do. We can take the amendment now, or we can talk about the general bill, whatever you prefer, Madam Chair. Or take the witness.
Sure. Why don't we hear from Mr. Botsick, and then we can discuss the amendment. Welcome, Mr. Botsick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Gary Botsick, Executive Director of Minnesota Conservation Federation. When I testified in favor of this bill and policy a little over a week ago, I was joined by Lance Ness from the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance, Harvey Nelson from Minnesota Waterfowl Association, Steve Thorne from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, John Curry from Minnesota Audubon, and Jim Bietz from Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. None of those gentlemen could be with us today, but they asked me to add their names to the record in continued support for this provision. We, too, were pleased to see the governor's supplemental budget and the two-year extension. That buys us more time, but as Senator Sodvir just Shafri just mentioned, this has not solved the problem, so I appreciate it as being an amendment. It gives us more time to work on it, but we are strong supporters of the Outdoor Recreation Act. I was doing a little research on the computer myself last night, Madam Chair, in preparation for this, but the Outdoor Recreation Act was initiated or passed by legislature in 1975. In fact, my first year that I was here, in fact, working for the Senate Republican caucus when this bill passed. I don't remember it, but it did pass 1975, and we've added, there's 11 categories that have been added to the Outdoor Recreation Act. Some of these were in place before the Outdoor Recreation Act, led by the wildlife management areas, which we're, as conservation people, very proud of. There are 1.2 million acres in our wildlife management systems now, almost 1,400 sites, and we're adding to that yearly. We've got a new 20-year plan that we're working from that'll add another 700,000 acres to that system. This all began in 1951 under a campaign called Save the Wetlands, if you can believe that. We're still fighting to save the wetlands 35, 40 years later, and we'll never stop fighting to save wetlands. We've added the scientific and natural areas in 1969. There's over 140 natural areas protected in Minnesota now. Aquatic management areas were added in 1992. Lakes, lakefronts, river fronts, it's basically designed to buy and protect habitat for fisheries, and works quite well. I'm reading quotes from Jack Skrypek, who many of you remember ran the fisheries and ecoservices when they were combined. Some great information on the website from him that I read last night. This Outdoor Recreation Act works well for Minnesota and needs to be protected. 15% of the Minnesotans hunt, more than double of that fish, but 52% watch wildlife now. We know how important that is to get outside, enjoy the open spaces, help with water retention, carbon sequestration, some of the nuances that we didn't even know our great outdoors can provide are being stressed, and we feel this is a very appropriate action for the legislature to look at and hopefully to resolve. So with that, Madam Chair, I will stop and take any questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Botsick. Thanks for giving us that long-term perspective. It really elevates the importance here, I think, of what we're talking about. I think I'm going to have Mr. Mueller go through the amendment, and then we can consider that.
Madam Chair, the amendment, the A1 amendment, excuse me, like Senator Chaudhary mentioned, just merely extends the time period from which this land sale has to take place out 2 more years. The net effect of this does not change the end of 2010-2011 forecast deficit we have. It just shifts the year that we'll be collecting the revenue. This isn't exactly the same what the governor is doing. The governor has proposed a 2-year delay, much like this amendment does, but this amendment, coinciding with the rest of Senator Chaudhary's bill, would prohibit a big chunk of lands that would be available to meet this goal. So I would assume if this passes into law, finance would have to sort of recalculate the types of lands that it would have available to meet this 2011 deadline, and I don't think they would foresee any sales that would happen yet this year that would help meet that, and it would probably push the revenues coming in out into the next biennium. So the governor's proposal still has another $2 million coming in this fiscal year because it is assuming it will be able to put up for sale a lot of the pieces of land that Senator Chaudhary's bill would basically prohibit them from doing. So it's not exactly the same what the governor is doing, but it's partially.
Okay. All right. Senator Chaudhary, would you like to move the amendment?
Move the A1.
All right. Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. I wonder if perhaps we should hear from the department briefly on this. And I don't know who wants to speak. But we want to focus on Mr. Meyer or somebody. Does anybody want to talk to him?
Madam Chair, I'm Marty Vadis, and I'm the director of the Lands and Minerals Division of DNR. And just a couple of comments. I think it may have already been covered in previous hearings. The bill would really limit or almost completely eliminate all of the DNR-managed lands that would be available to meet that budget balancing requirement. The only thing that we would have left to offer would be essentially administrative sites. And so it would be, you know, DNR office buildings. And occasionally, but rarely, those are put up for sale. And just point out, DNR now has that authority from last session to put that into a facilities account to improve or acquire other facilities. And so, as I understand the proposals, it would really eliminate all of the virtually all the lands that we have on a proposed sale list for this spring to be used for the budget balancing purpose. And also in reading the handout materials here, it appears as though the budget issue, there would still be an expectation that DNR would generate $2 million of revenue in fiscal 10. And so just point out that should the bill pass in the present form, It would prevent the ability to sell land from the outdoor revenue system or outdoor recreation system and leave us with administrative sites. And I think the expectation is we would sell $2 million worth of administrative sites or pay. And that would be a very difficult spot to be in.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Vadis. Senator Chaudhary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The law that asked for the $6.4 million in sales for this budget issue applies to all state departments. So by saying that just the outdoor rec accounts would not be included, it does not shift the burden to the DNR just to meet that $2 million goal or whatever their goal is just from administrative costs. So it's the law remains that the money has to come from all state lands. But then I guess I'm a little more confused because the governor has proposed that they extend the sale of all the lands, not just outdoor rec, but all to 2011. So no lands can be sold for the general fund under the governor's proposal. So my bill actually doesn't go as far. I only say we're just not going to let the outdoor rec lands be sold. So actually, if we're talking about a budget hole, the governor's proposed extension creates a bigger one, or actually creates one. Mine doesn't create one at all. So, but I mean, I think it's good. But for another policy reason, number one, land prices are very, very low, and I think the difficulty wherever you look, whether it's outdoor rec, DNR, or whatever, is going to be hugely difficult to reach the goal with the with land values being so depressed. So for that reason, the extension is probably warranted. So we can let some of the values bounce back, and so we don't have to sell as much land to reach this figure. So we need to do, I support the extension, but we need to do both. We need to exempt the outdoor rec lands as well.
I agree with you, Senator Chaudhry. I think this is a good bill, and we should pass it. And, you know, if it, maybe it just wasn't, well, the whole policy may need to be revisited, obviously, but by the full finance committee, who can think about if they're going to be able to find that amount of land somewhere else besides in the outdoor recreation system and whether that obligation should continue or not. And I just don't think this is what the public supports, and I don't think it makes sense. And I keep thinking about the constitutional amendment and all those 1.6 million voters, and they certainly didn't expect us to be selling off recreation land at the same time that we're taxing them to buy more. And you could even argue it's supplanting. It could potentially be supplanting, depending on which purchases we're talking about. Some of this land could be up for sale, and then a local unit of government could look for legacy dollars to buy it. And it just doesn't make any sense. So this is we don't want that to happen. So I think what we're going to propose is that, I mean, this bill does need to go to the full finance committee and let the finance committee talk about the broader budget implications of it. And at the same time, we may want to, when we do our omnibus bill, our budget bill, we should probably include this as well. And maybe we can do that by an amendment later on so that we make sure that the policy and the dollars are connected and that the finance committee doesn't lose sight of that. So. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on Senate File 353? All right, hearing none. Senator Chaudhry, would you like to move the bill?
Move the Senate File 353 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Very good. On that motion, any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails. Thank you. All right, Senator Scogin, you have your star witness here. Senator Rosen, I'm wondering if you're getting kind of some compensation for all the lobbying you've been doing lately, because she came and testified for one of my bills yesterday. And
wearing my Senate hat today.
Very, okay.
It's crazy. Just crazy.
Cancel Stump's bill. Okay, it's still in. All right, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. Today, before you have Senate File 1194, and Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A1 amendment to put the bill in shape.
Senator Scogin, this bill was, wasn't this heard in the Energy Committee?
A different form of this bill was, and by the time we got around to fixing it up, it had changed so much we decided to start over. When we went back to Senator Pretner Solon, she said that she looked it over and she said, why don't you just take it right on to Senator Anderson? And so that's why we're here today with our first stop.
Okay. Well, then we will treat this as an author's amendment. Would someone move the A1 author's amendment? Senator Saxhog. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails. All right. Senator Scogin, do we have the amendment yet? Oh, sorry, members. I was a little fast.
Greg just left. Maybe.
Madam Chair, they're a trusting group. They're a trusting group.
Yeah. Well, it is an author's amendment.
On the prevailing side.
Yeah. I know it was. I got a copy of it earlier today, so that's kind of funny. It's not here. So we'll get that straightened out, and maybe you can explain the bill, and then as soon as we have the amendment, you can explain that.
What we're hoping to accomplish here, Madam Chair and members, is to open the door for smaller renewable energy units. Wind, solar, hydroelectric. We're kind of taking a look at some potential use of federal stimulus money and offering some grants to people who are willing to invest in these projects, and the smaller ones, 40 kW or less. Senator Rosen originally had a piece that was a little different, and then I had a piece, and we tried to put them together, and it got kind of all complicated and a little bit burdensome to do that, so that's why we come back with 1194 as you see it today. We have two witnesses, and maybe I'll introduce Dan Matfield first, and he can just kind of explain what they do with the wind portion and how this bill might affect their business and the customers that they serve.
All right, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Matfield. I am the general manager for a company in New York Mills, Minnesota, called Residential Wind Power. And what we do is we sell and install small wind systems, wind turbine systems for residential, small business, small farm use. They're not the extremely large ones that you see decorating our countryside. They're smaller units made to produce, you know, household quality, household amount electricity. And this bill would give the consumers an incentive to actually purchase these units, become a little bit more self-sufficient when it comes to electrical, cutting their bills, and it would also, because of that, it would increase job potential in Minnesota, throughout Minnesota as well, with other small companies that do the same thing that we do, who we have spoken to.
All right, thank you, Mr. Matfield. Can you, I know I asked you some of these, probably that was you in the other committee, some questions. Tell us just how much it costs to put up one of these systems for a home, average homeowner, and how much of their electricity it would cover?
Well, it would depend upon the size of the unit. You know, if you buy, like, the smaller units, they're going to produce between 300, 400, maybe 500 kilowatts of electricity monthly, which would, and those units themselves cost between $12,000 and $15,000 to install. The larger systems, up to, we only sell up to about 10 kilowatt size, but they have potential to produce 1,500 to 2,000 kilowatts, which is more per month, which is more than the average home actually uses. And those run anywhere in the neighborhood of $33,000 to $35,000.
Okay. Well, we'll get to the specifics on how the bill would spend the money maybe when we have the amendment in front of us. So we'll stop there. Are there other questions for Mr. Matfield? All right. Thank you. Is it Mr. Sullivan?
It is, Madam Chair. Can you hear me okay here? Hi, my name is Joe Sullivan. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Sullivan. I'm with Flaherty and Hood, and we're here representing Missouri River Energy Services. MRES is a municipal power agency. We serve 24 communities in greater Minnesota, as well as communities in North and South Dakota and Iowa. And we support Senate File 1194. The intent of the bill is to use a small portion of the federal stimulus dollars, $1 million, to create a broad-based incentive for all Minnesotans to purchase renewable projects for their residential or small business use. Examples of this would be, like Mr. Matfield said, a small wind turbine, but it could be applied to a solar panel that somebody wants to build in their, you know, on their house in South Minneapolis or St. Paul. Biomass, anaerobic digestion. The point of the bill is to match up with the state's currently existing net metering law. So your project qualifies under, if it qualifies for net metering, which means it's 40 kilowatts or smaller, 40 kW or smaller, if it is generates electricity by a renewable source, and if it's connected to the grid. It would be a $2,500 grant towards the purchase of a small project. Or 30, 35%, whichever is smaller. And another one of the reasons that we think this is a good approach is because it replaces the current patchwork of incentives out there, and it's just broad-based. It's very transparent. It's very clean. If you have a small project, you get the grant, basically. That's the way that we think that it should be structured, and you shouldn't have to go through some Byzantine kind of research process to find out, does my project qualify? This is just very, very clean and flat. Also, it's important to note that the grant does not replace any of the existing rebates or tax credits or grants. It would be on top of that. So in that sense, I think it's important to look at this legislation as a way to pull people into the door. You know, here's $2,500 towards the purchase, but if you qualify for something else, you'll get that on top of it. So from our perspective, so much the better. And we think that makes it, you know, much stronger and more likely to actually be an incentive. And finally, the reason that Missouri River is supportive of this is because we think that these large state grants like this, or a state grant like this, an incentive like this, is a great way to really incentivize small-scale distributed generation at the residential or small business level. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Madam Chair,
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, I have a more general question. What other incentives are there for a homeowner, for example, to buy one of these systems? You know, dollar wise, what dollar incentive would there be?
Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson. Now, my knowledge is not exhaustive on this, but I can tell you what I'm aware of right now. The state has a solar rebate program that has been very successful people can qualify for if they're building.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Sullivan, sorry to interrupt you, but specific to wind energy.
As far as wind energy, I think that Mr. Matfield will be the best.
Currently, at the state level, there is zero. There is no incentive whatsoever by the state of Minnesota for any incentive to purchase small wind. The only incentive other than that would be there's a federal federal plan that was implemented last year to provide a 30% of total installed price tax credit for anyone who were to purchase a small wind system in the United States.
And do you know, is that just for 2009 or is that for an extended period of time?
I'm actually not sure of the time frame.
So you could get potentially a 30% tax credit, plus if we offered this $2,500, that could add up to about two-thirds of the cost, potentially, roughly. Half the cost, you're right. That's not 30%, $2,500. So do the utilities offer any incentives for this?
Currently, no. I've done extensive research through the state and all other power companies like Otter Tail Power, Lake Region, and there is currently really nothing that they offer as any type of incentive.
But they would get the credit for this under the renewable energy standard, correct?
Actually, yes, they would. Albeit a small,
yes.
Very small number.
Yes.
But yes, it would work to their benefit as well.
Okay. Is this the amendment?
This is the first in gross.
No. This is a different bill.
Madam Chair.
What is going on here?
Madam Chair, Mr. Matfield.
Senator Fredrickson.
The reason I was asking the question is I was just doing some very simple arithmetic on my pad here, and I believe you said that a small unit would cost from $12,000 to $15,000.
Correct.
And it would generate from 300 to 500 kilowatt hours per month.
Correct.
If you take 500 kilowatt hours per month at 10 cents per kilowatt, that's $50 a month.
Right.
So for the year, you would save, a homeowner would save $600 by providing their own
correct
their own electrical power. But $12,000 at just 4% interest is $480, almost a, just a little less than the savings, with right. nothing towards paying the principal.
Right, and that's why we're looking for the incentive to, you know, to help. Because another option, to, another way to look at it, too, is, you know, once the initial purchase is made, okay, let's you've got the tower, foundation, and everything installed in the initial installation, that tower is going to be able to stay there indefinitely. So if, say, 15 years later, you know, you purchased one of these 15 years later, you've handed the farm or your house over to your kids, and the turbine fails, all they have to purchase now is a new turbine to put on top, which would be much less expensive.
So how many years do these turbines last?
The,
are they warrantied for a certain period of time?
They're warrant both. The majority of the turbines that we sell are all warrantied for 5 years, which is actually much larger than most companies in that sell in the U.S.
Thank you.
But they're like the, our smaller system is expected to have a life of about 20 years, and our larger system that we sell, and this is just the ones we sell. I can't speak for anybody else who sells a different brand or manufacturer. And but our larger one is scheduled or figured to last approximately 25 to 30 years.
Okay, Senator Frederickson, I'm going back to what you're putting the numbers together here. So if you get a 30% tax credit, is that a dollar-for-dollar tax credit? Is that how tax credits work, or does it have to be based on, I mean, it's off of your tax liability. I forget how that works. It's been a long time since I've done my taxes. So basically, you just get a third of the cost that you can just straight credit against taxes owed? Is that how those work usually?
Madam Chair, I've always Senator been on the Finance Committee, and I've never been on the Tax Committee. But I believe a tax credit would
it's not a deduction.
It would depend on how it was worded in the tax law. I would read that is that you would have to have more than a $4,000 tax obligation to claim it. But it might depend on how it's
well,
framed also.
If it's against your income, then I think most of us would have more than that if we're going to be able to afford one of these. If we, you know, and so if your tax liability is in, well, I don't know,
yeah, maybe Mr.
You know,
Sullivan knows
30-40% range for most yeah. of. Okay, Mr. Sullivan, do you want
Madam
to help
Chair,
us on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, just two quick points. In my research of how the tax credits generally work is that you can't get money back from the tax credit. So if your tax obligation is $800 but the credit is $2,500, you're not going to get, you know, a $1,700 check back. But what you can do usually is carry them forward to previous to upcoming years. But the so the second point that I did want to mention, though, is that as far as a general subsidy, or not general subsidy, but an incentive, I think it's important to note that the state's net metering laws is also offers a incentive where, you know, people at the, you know, the residential, building a residential, you know, wind turbine or a solar panel are getting the retail rate for electricity. So I think that's important to note.
30% of that or something like that?
Well,
I'm just okay. So, say you make $100,000 and you have federal tax income tax liability in the tens of thousands. So, you'd be able to deduct 30% of the cost against that liability, I would think. It's not against the taxes paid on this item. It's on your income
right.
tax liability, correct? So, I think it would be, you know, if you're going to have if you're going to be buying your own wind turbine, you probably have to have a decent income to start with. So, let's assume you can you have at least, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 tax liability for the 30% of the cost is what $4,000 to $5,000. So you could deduct or you could credit $4,000 or $5,000 against your tax liability, and then you'd get $2,500 on top of that. And yeah, it's like you said, about 50% of the cost. But then if you have to borrow money, then you're going to be, how long would it take you to pay it back? I guess that's what I'm trying to figure out. If you have to borrow money to pay for this and the interest earnings are more or less the same as the income you're making from it, then however long it took you to pay off the loan, I guess, is when you'd start making money. Anyway, I mean, I wonder if having a zero interest loan fund might be as good a way to
stimulate
the buying of these products.
Senator Rosen, I think, has some clarification on the federal portion of
Great. Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, members, as far as we know, the credit is 30% and up to $4,000, and it goes to December 31st of 2016. Oh. So it's substantial. Unless they've changed just recently, that is current.
Okay, that's great. Senator Rosen, is there anything more you wanted to say about the...
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just would like to say that Senator Scogin's done a really great job with this bill. We both testified on separate bills in the Energy Committee, and very similar, going down the same path, and he's worked on it with Mr. Sullivan and Mr. Matfield and some others to develop the 1194, and then it's morphed. But the reason that I was interested in this small wind production is because of the animal production out in my Senate district or in greater Minnesota, and hopefully the market turns around here pretty soon for hogs, but I could foresee these on large hog production or turkey production or dairy production. I mean, this is something that they would invest in because people are looking for renewables, what they can do just for themselves. And of course, this is statewide, and we could do the solar panels in the Twin Cities or even, I don't know, maybe in some areas, small wind turbines. But out in greater Minnesota has a great benefit to people that want to do something in this area. They just don't know how to go about it. And I believe what we could do farther down the road is have kind of a one-stop shop, a location where people can go to find out where the dollars are, where the grant money is, how to go about, you know, going down this path of renewables on a small scale. So that would be my only plug for maybe the Office of Energy Security having their website up to say, here's some grant money. I'm going off here, but this is just a fun project, and I just think there are manufacturers out there that are bringing these products online. And there's people that want to get in this area, so that's why these bills were developed.
Senator Scogin?
Well, Madam Chair and members, I also want to go on record that I understand that net metering does have an effect on my rural electric co-ops, my municipals, my investor owns, and when people are allowed to come in with these smaller units and plug into the grid, that has an effect on their consumers. But I also believe it's important that we start to open some of those doors and see if we can make some of this renewable available to them. Thank you.
Matfeld, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to inform Senator Rosen that it was just weeks ago, in fact, that the federal, which had the $4,000 cap, it went back around and they removed the cap. So it's 30% flat, depending in without regards to total cost. I don't know if they changed the date, but I do know that they did change that there's no longer a $4,000 cap on it. It's 30% of total cost of installation, and the fact that there's also
I like that because it includes.
On the sale of any type of renewable energy in the state of Minnesota, there is no sales tax. It's tax exempt. Sales tax.
Senator Torres Ray, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I wanted to ask either of the witness if you can tell me kind of what kind of business, what size business, could really afford this, because the cost of the $12,000 to $15,000 does not include the installation, right? So it will be additional cost to the installation. So technically, a business owner will have to come up with about $15,000 to $17,000, or how much would a business owner have to invest up front to take advantage of this?
Madam Chair, Senator Torres, right?
Mr. Madfield.
That's actually, that those numbers I gave were actually an install price. That is including cost of installation. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up. So could you give me an idea of what businesses in your practice have taken advantage of this kind of opportunity? Because technically you're supposed to have really a good chunk of money in order to take advantage of this.
Right. Actually, which businesses specifically, I couldn't say. We have had inquiries about them from businesses. Like there's a gentleman up north of Detroit Lakes who wants to, who's building, I do believe it is, a gas station convenience store, and he wants to put up several of them to help to promote, you know, the clean energy, even though he's, you know, selling, you know, fossil fuels. But we have had people who have a honey. They make honey in their at their farm. You know, that would be another one. We've had people come through who have, like, ceramic shops in their homes. The list is, I would have to have all of my, everybody that's inquired in front of me to know exactly, but I mean, there's, it's just a broad range of people who would be interested.
Okay, Senator Hamm.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. And I apologize if you answered this. I came a little bit late here to this discussion, but what is the income that these systems would generate? I mean, if I spent my money and invested in making, what kind of income would that generate?
Well, it,
Mr. Madfield.
Senator, it would depend upon, first of all, the size of the system you purchased, the money you invested, based, you know, going against your electrical need. You know, if you were to purchase a 40 kilowatt turbine at $90,000 to $100,000, and then, but you're only using 800 kilowatts of electricity, you know, you're gonna make income on it. But I don't know, most people aren't looking at it as an income base. They're looking more as a little more self-sufficient with their electrical, and to also do even their small part to provide cleaner energy than we've been producing for hundreds of years.
Senator Hand, Senator Frederickson had figured out a pretty good sample calculation on if you bought a small turbine. What was that, 600 a year, perhaps?
Well, Madam Chair, the first example we saw was one of these units would cost from $12,000 to $15,000 and would generate from 300 to 500 kilowatt hours per month. And assuming the lowest cost of $12,000 and the highest output at 500 kilowatts at 10 cents a kilowatt hour, which I believe is fairly high retail, would be about $50 a month that it would generate. And multiply that times 12 for the 12 months, it'd be $600 a year of energy that'd be producing for a $12,000 investment.
So our estimate based on that smaller scale is that you could cover about half the cost of the purchase with between the tax credit and this type of incentive, but that doesn't include any interest costs if you had to borrow the money.
And Madam Chair, I want to say I realize there are other reasons for buying these units other than just the pure financial also.
But if we're going to use stimulus dollars to put an incentive in place, we need to know that it's actually going to change people's behavior and get them to go out and buy these, and that it's going to add up to a much more financially viable package than is currently available. I mean, that's the point of it, and we just need to really evaluate it for that purpose to see if this is the best use of those dollars. Members, just to remind you, we have a lot of, well, a number, not a lot, but I don't have a number. No, I mean bills that have been introduced to spend some of the stimulus dollars that are energy related. And this is one of them. We're going to hear a few more over the next week. I'm hoping that we can put that bill together over the next week or so and get it passed out of this division if our leadership allows us to pass that bill separately, which I'm hoping they will, so we can put that money to work quickly as it was intended for. And this is one of the proposals that I think is really intriguing that might be a good use of some of those dollars if it could put, you know, put some energy projects up quickly. One question is whether we should require that if you're going to get state money for this that you have to buy it from a Minnesota manufacturer. What do you think about that?
Well, Madam Chair, we're starting to hear Washington that that is not necessarily a good idea, that as we work in a global economy, the more we isolate ourselves, the harder it is sometimes to rebound. So as much as I would encourage people to shop locally and shop Minnesotan, I think we have to be careful that we don't tie our hands.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, just from what I learned with the TFA bill that I'm carrying, there's a Buy American, which I think most members, Buy American clause in the Federal Stimulus Act. So,
I'm not sure if it applies to this.
I'm not sure if it is either,
money,
but it does for PFA.
It does for the money that's definitely designated for public infrastructure. Yeah, and this is, I mean, the state energy plan money is pretty broad, but I don't know. We'll have to check on that. And then one last question. Can you, I mean, these are much smaller turbines than the utility scale ones that are really tall. So how does that affect where you can site them around the state? Does it mean you have to be in an even windier area to be able to have them be produce that number of, that amount of power that you, that Senator Fredrickson was talking about?
Well, Madam Chair, it would depend greatly upon location. You know, if you've got, let's say, a wide open area on your farm where you can place one of these, you're going to have, you know, no issue from trees. Mm-hmm. So at, you know, 45 feet in the air versus 100, yes, there will be a difference, but not a tremendous difference.
Right, but we probably won't be seeing a lot of these in the suburbs of St. Paul,
no,
for example.
Exactly. There have been some places where you can find them sitting right in the backyard in a suburb. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got pictures of them in a backyard in a little suburb cul-de-sac in New Jersey. You know, one more thing, if I may mention, Madam Chair, as far as the comment about, you know, purchasing them from Minnesota dealers. As far as my knowledge goes, there are only two manufacturers in Minnesota that actually make, produce, and sell wind turbines. And I won't use any names of any companies, but one of them has never been very reputable. They haven't been very reliable. No offense to Minnesota engineering, but it just never has been. You know, all of the turbines that our company sells are manufactured in the United States. But
thank you. And the delete all amendment does, we check that the definition here at the beginning does refer to a 40 kV system or less, so it does refer back to that same definition.
That's correct.
Any other discussion of the bill, Senator Scogan, anything else? Senator Torres Ray.
Madam Chair, just a comment that, you know, I hope that for the Energy Committee and for this committee that we keep in mind kind of the utility of this in terms of kind of how far we can go and how much money we need to invest in systems that are efficient. So if the individual, I would love to do the same thing with, you know, the exercise that we did here with the bigger unit, so that let's say you have a cooperative of farmers that may be able to purchase one but is more cost effective than having small systems for individual farms. And I don't know, so I think that it is important that we look at cost and efficiency to invest the few dollars that we may be able to invest, because I am not sure that I know enough to say, you know, is it better to invest in providing grants for $12,000 units, or is it better to use $1 million to get fewer, bigger systems that may help a group of farmers rather than individual farms? So I would like to know more about that. If we do make that decision, what is the most efficient use of our dollars with the current technology?
Well, Senator Torres Ray, I guess my quick answer to that, at least from my perspective, is that we've done quite a lot to generate incentives for larger projects and also for sort of cooperative projects through the seabed law that allows that, you know, that allows a group of Minnesotans to get together and put a project together locally. And we do have that law in place. And, you know, it's not a strict mandate on utilities, but most of the utilities see it as kind of a soft mandate and are trying to buy from some seabed projects or locally owned projects. We used to have an incentive program for small wind projects. That money's long gone. And so we don't really have much in the way of incentives, as Mr. Macfeld said, for very small distributed renewable energy facilities. It's hard as an individual homeowner or farmer to get the capital together to do this. And anyway, so I think it's a good idea to try to put some incentives in place, but we do have to make sure they're cost effective. Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I've been trying to decide whether I'm 100% sure this is right, the right path, or 100% sure it's the wrong path.
There's no gray area, huh?
And it's very hard to be 100% sure on either side of this. And I know back in the days when we were dealing with ethanol and trying to decide whether or not we should subsidize it and have a mandated market and give them tax-free zones and tax increment financing zones and low-interest loans and give the farmers low-interest loans and grants to buy into the stock of the ethanol plant, I wasn't 100% sure that was a good idea because I didn't know how it was all going to work out in the end, and I knew the gas mileage wasn't that good and so forth. But after the price of oil went up over $100 a barrel, I decided it was time to be 100% sure it was a good idea because it was at that time. But I'm just stating an opinion here that I'm kind of getting to more and more to the side of not being sure we're on the right track with all these renewables, and we're trying to keep our state competitive, and we got this greenhouse gas issue. Is Al Gore really, really, really right, or isn't he? And I'm no longer 100% sure Al Gore is right. So all this, and now we're pouring more money into subsidized energy. And it's going to run up the cost. Now, the gentleman mentioned it was going to be $12,000 to $15,000 per tower. My guess is that does that even include all the costs of getting everything hooked up and so forth? Is that the total cost of getting the system in place? And I'm just expressing a view that I'm kind of moving a little bit more toward not being 100% sure we're on the right track with this whole renewable energy thing that we're working on.
Well, Senator Dill, and I don't want to get into a really long debate. This is a big, big question that you're raising, and we're not going to resolve it right now. I guess I just have to say for the record that, you know, where did I just read this yesterday? The energy markets are the most heavily subsidized industries that we have in the United States. And every form of energy is very heavily subsidized. And so I think we tend to single out the subsidies we talk about for renewables, but we don't talk about subsidies for every other sort of energy. And if we took away every subsidy and let them stand on their own, I think we'd have a very different picture of our energy markets. And so I would argue that small, you know, that new forms of energy that are emerging need to be subsidized if they're good, if they have other benefits to the public. And certainly energy sources that don't have emissions, that's a benefit to the public. And ownership of individuals that makes them independent from oil fields across the world in hostile places, that's a benefit to the public too, I would think. And so whether Al Gore is 100% right or only 90% right or 50% right, I don't think that really matters because in the end, if we have less emissions, cleaner air, and more independence, that's a win-win for our citizens. And you know, maybe in 10 years we should be reevaluating whether subsidies are needed for wind. I hope they won't be. I don't think they will be, and I don't think they're needed for ethanol anymore, but they were to get it started and off the ground. So here I go. I've responded to the debate, and so now I want to stop it. Sorry. That's the prerogative of the chair. I apologize, because we do need to move on. We have three more bills, and it's a great discussion and conversation, and I wish you were on the Energy Committee, but you're on the Energy Commission, Senator Dill. Anyway. All right. Would someone like to move that this bill be laid on the table for consideration for possible inclusion in the stimulus budget bill? Senator Saxhog moves.
1194, as amended.
You recommended for passage and laid on the table for possible inclusion in the stimulus budget bill.
So moved.
All right. On that motion, is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Senator Fredrickson. Well,
we have never, I think, been at a single committee in the whole legislature, in either body, to discuss how much competition we want to demand in any, I don't care what field it is. Job creation.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, members, I've asked Mr. Terry Coleman from the Public Facilities Authority to join me at the table. And also attending the meeting today from the Department of Health is John Schnickel, and from PCA, Mr. Bill Dunn. I'm going to refer to a couple documents that I believe are in your packet. One has the PFA logo on the top, and its heading is American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. And the other is a division report that is actually the bill from which I would like to work. And that division report is from Senator Tomasoni's Economic Development and Housing Budget Division.
Senator Fredrickson, this is an unusual. We have a little bit of discussion about where, well, both of our committees have an interest, let's say, over wastewater treatment issues this session, especially in regards to stimulus bills. So that's why your bill is here. But we're going to work off the division report from Senator Tomasoni's committee. So I would, Senator Fredrickson moves adoption of the division report, and we'll work off of that, which is the document that says Senator Cohen chair on the top.
Oh, okay.
For Senate File 1329. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. All right. Senator Fredrickson, go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, I'm going to briefly work off the PFA information sheet just to touch three or four essential elements of that, and then I'd like to walk through the bill. Minnesota will receive some $107 million of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act for clean water and drinking water infrastructure projects. 50% of the total funds have to be used for grants. A minimum of 20% of the total funds must be used to address green infrastructure, energy, and water efficiency improvements. All the projects must comply with the Davis-Bacon Prevailing Wage Act, Buy American Iron, Steel, and Manufacturing Goods. And 50%, and this is an important item here, 50% of the funds must be under contract within 120 days from the time the bill became law, the federal bill became law, and that was February 17, 2009. And the projects for clean water must be on the MPCA's intended use list, and for drinking water they must be on the Department of Health list. And because this is federal legislation and there are specific requirements, we need to change slightly some of the Minnesota laws that we have dealing with the clean water and drinking water laws. So, Madam Chair, members, with that, I'd like to go to the division report that we've adopted. And Section 1 makes changes to the Clean Water Revolving Fund so that we would be in compliance with the federal law. Under existing law, the loans have to be repaid within 20 years. Under the federal law, we have to have provisions that under certain circumstances, the loans can go for 30 years. You can see on line 19, we've striking 20 years and inserting those allowed under the Federal Water Pollution Control Act. And those loans that would be extended for 30 years would be those where the cost of the loan would exceed 1.4% of the median household income in the governmental unit or entity that's getting the loan. In those situations where the cost is more than 1.4% of the median household income, the loan would be for a term of 30 years rather than 20 years. Section 2 deals with our drinking water revolving fund, and the same changes that were made in Section 1 are being made in Section 2, and that's again to comply with the federal law. Section 3 is for the Clean Water Fund, and with the transfer of money that PFA was allowed to make between these programs, the Clean Water Fund would have $82,564,000. And that money would be credited to the Clean Water Revolving Fund in the Minnesota Law 446A07. And the authorization to make loans and grants under that section expire when all the money from this federal stimulus have been expended. And there's an interesting at the 228 and lines 28 and 29 grant includes principal forgiveness at the time that the grant the time principal forgiveness that is granted at the time a loan is made. That is how the grant is earned. Subdivision 2 grant required. There are some grants that are required to be made under the federal law. There are essentially three of them. There has to be a base grant of 20% on these projects. And when the cost of the projects exceeds the 1.4% of the median household income, there must be a grant to make up 80% of that difference. And when green infrastructure when green infrastructure projects are approved, they must include a 25% grant for the project. In Subdivision 3, you'll see that 20% of the money received under this act must be used to address green infrastructure, water, and energy efficiency improvements. Subdivision 4, you can see that the priority for these projects is as bid and in the order the projects are certified by the public of the Pollution Control Agency. And on 11 lines 11 and 12 of the page 3, you see that the base grant is 20% of the project. And again, I've already explained paragraph C where the 1.4% of median income and 80% needs to be a grant of the amount that's above that 1.4% of median household income. There's also a limit on how large a supplemental grant can be. That's on lines 24 and 25. Cannot exceed 80% of the total amount approved to be paid from the Clean Water Revolving Fund. Section 4 is the section for drinking water, and in the drinking water program there will be $24,577,000. Again, that money is credited to the Drinking Water Revolving Fund. There are, I believe, identical changes made in the drinking water statutes as I described in the clean water, but one difference is this is a list certified by the Department of Health, not the Pollution Control Agency. And at the end of the bill on page 5, lines 5 through 8, you can see projects that comply with the National Primary Drinking Water Standards must be provided with a 50% grant for the project cost up to a maximum of $10,000, and total grants approved under this paragraph cannot exceed $250,000. Madam Chair, that's a fairly quick walk through the bill. I'll ask Mr. Coleman if I missed anything that should have been highlighted, and stand for questions.
Thank you very much. Senator Rummel, did you have a question at this time? And then we'll turn to Mr. Coleman.
I did, Madam Chair. On page 3, lines 7 through 10, so the grants are awarded in the order that the projects are certified by the PSA, not in terms of the priority of the projects?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, that's correct.
Yeah, well, you want to just tell him. Isn't that good? Don't tell him for sure. Just say
it. Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, if I could clarify that. The stimulus bill specifically waived the priority system. They wanted projects that are ready to build. Again, the primary purpose is to create jobs as quickly as possible.
That was the key element, shovel ready.
Addressing the clean water needs at the same time.
Senator Rummel.
Going back then to the point that Senator Fredrickson made from this sheet, these projects have to be under construction within 120 days. And the clock started counting on February 17th, so virtually by May 17th, do these things have to be done or started? Or
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, June 17th, I believe, and it turned into a goal, because there's no EPA won't guarantee they'll give us a grant by May or by June 17th, so it's now a goal. Although they've committed to 120, or they committed to a 21-day turnaround once we can submit an application, and we can't submit until this bill is in law, so we can start making grants, because it requires grants. So we do not have the authority to make grants under the loan program. It's always been prohibited under the federal law to do so, so we never created a mechanism to do that.
Senator Pariseau.
I would just like to mention that in Senator Tomasoni's committee, he kept refreshing us, our memories on shovel-ready being the key element. I think that was part of the goal there, to make sure he impressed it on our brains.
Mr. Coleman, is there anything else you needed to say at this point?
No, just there's a tremendous amount of interest that has been generated since this is passed in Washington, and I don't think we'll have any problem getting the money on the contract. Actually, we looked at it. We anticipate about $200 million worth of construction contracts between now and the end of May, and another $200 million between now or from May to the end of the calendar year. So that, and we've already did $148 million in loans already this fiscal year, so we'll be doing probably three times what we normally do in a given year.
It would be useful to figure out how many jobs that will create, and I don't know if you have that information, but maybe as the bill moves forward, it would be nice to have that just for members' information and the public's information, because it must be a lot.
Roughly, Madam Chair, depending on the type of the project, between 20 and 40 jobs per $1 million are actual workers. I mean, some of them will just work a few days. Some of them will be employed for a year and a half, 2 years. Some of the larger projects that, like Met Council undertakes, you're looking at a 5 to 7 year construction cycle, but it varies across the board. If you're looking at FTEs, the direct jobs in construction jobs, you're looking at about 6 jobs per $1 million.
Senator Saxon.
And Madam Chair, in some of the bigger instances, you're talking about industrial projects that are going to be dependent on these being finished too. So that's more.
Now, a couple questions. First of all, you have to get on the list, and there's an extended deadline for that. Did you say that date?
Yes, Madam Chair. We've recently posted an amendment to the intended use plan to solicit public comment. So anybody that was currently on P
PSA is project priority list, and we reduced the cutoff from 45 points to 35 points. It added another 80 million of eligible projects that we were aware of that have approved facility plans. So they'll have until sometime in May to actually get an application into us and bid it before the end of the fiscal year. We are also opening up, and PCA is opening up, and Department of Health opening up their project priority list, which is currently have, I think, a May 1st deadline or May 5th deadline to get on those lists for July 1st, and then we'll start the whole process over come July 1st, so all the new projects that come in we'll start working with as well. Again, the real key to the stimulus money is bid and under construction, and pretty confident we're going to get rid of the money on the wastewater side yet this fiscal year, maybe into July. Drinking water, July, August, but it'll be gone by then.
So I have a couple more questions. We talked yesterday about a proposal I have the bill for to reuse wastewater for industrial purposes, and that would be an eligible project under one of these categories, maybe under the 20% set aside?
Eligible in multiple areas. If it's really looking at additional treatment to use it, that could fall under the regular program. Otherwise, the 20% set aside required for water conservation, it also includes water reuse, things like that, would be eligible for the 25% grant,
and
75% loan.
Do those have to be on the same the project list also to be get when that it comes set aside?
Madam Chair, when it comes to the green technology component, they need to get on the list, but we are going to run a separate, and they have to be eligible, but we are going to run a separate request for proposal because a lot of communities don't, get on the list for that specific purpose. So as soon as the bill passes, we are going to go out on a request for proposal. PCA has already got a separate application developed for people that are strictly interested in that component. Try to, I believe, create a list of projects that are ready to go. So it'll be a lot of stormwater treatment components, which rank fairly low, energy conversion creation, wastewater treatment plants, water reuse, and various methods are all eligible. So there's quite a wide variety of eligible projects that historically haven't been very competitive.
And so we heard another proposal yesterday for funding for some stormwater treatment around Green Lake that would be, and they said they don't score high on the traditional request list because their lake isn't impaired. It's too clean, but it's still polluted, and they want to reduce the phosphorus loading. So would something like that potentially be eligible for this RFP?
Yes, Madam Chair, as long as it's doing more than just holding water. It's treating it and letting it seep in the groundwater,
yes,
stuff like that. Yes, yes, that's the intent.
It's all about trying to reduce phosphorus and nutrient loading into the lake.
Yes, and
treating runoff that is otherwise running in through stormwater inlets. So that's exactly what it is.
I should comment, too, that the House or Congress in the House has already passed the reauthorization bill for the Clean Water Act, which includes making that 20% set-aside permanent in federal law, so that will help those type of projects have access to the money where, traditionally it's been wastewater, and then we got into point source or non-point source pollution activities like Ag BMP and PCA's Clean Water Partnership Loan Program about a decade ago, but we haven't really gotten into the stormwater, and that's a big issue when you're addressing water quality that we're moving into with TMDL studies.
And that brings up another question. Some people have suggested if you either need to do a wastewater treatment improvement program, do something to improve your system, or you have to do a stormwater runoff program to meet either one to meet your TMDL, that you couldn't be eligible for these dollars. Is that true?
They'd both be eligible. I mean, the city could come in and do both.
Well, it sounds to me, Senator Frederickson, this is raising a lot of questions in my mind because there's a lot of proposals that are floating through the process for projects that would be likely eligible for some of these funds. And I obviously you want to get this bill passed quickly so the process can begin and the money can start getting being put to work. We have to figure out where to send all these great ideas so that you can include them in your RFP at a minimum, or if maybe we should pass them into law in another bill to try to, you know, direct how this set-aside is used. What's the, 20%, how much money are we talking about again for the 20% set-aside for the?
Roughly $16 million, Madam Chair,
$4 million
would be grant. We're not really capping the loan side of it, but at least $4 million in grant, and if we get more proposals, we'll do more in loan.
Okay. Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not reserving my comments just to the PFA portion of this. I've been running into a number of senators in the hallways in the last couple of weeks, and there's a lot of frustration about not understanding how to help their local communities and access some of this federal stimulus money. There just doesn't seem to be a place that helps them understand what qualifies for what and where they should go and how they get on lists. And the frustration is pretty high out there, and I don't know if there's any plan to clarify for folks what to do and who to contact. And
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, we probably haven't done the best job educating representatives and senators, but when it comes to the smaller communities, we've met with Minnesota Rural Water, which almost every city in the state under 10,000 population is a member. At their annual conference in St. Cloud, we reserved a room. My staff were there, PCA staff, and Health Department of Health, along with the League of Cities, and just presented this proposal for legislation a week or two after the stimulus bill passed, actually like a week after the stimulus bill passed, and got a lot of response. And all the engineers in the state that do drinking water systems and wastewater systems are very familiar with our process. We have loans outstanding, I would say, to roughly 420, 30 communities, so they know us out there, about any town of 300 or greater. We've been working with USDA Rural Development that has field offices all around the state, and they also have stimulus money and double their usual funding. So we are kind of coordinating all that stuff. But the real key is if you've got a wastewater problem, you need to be working with Pollution Control Agency. They're the ones that, whether you're replacing a 100-foot of pipe that cracked, you got to get a permit from them, and you need to work with them to get on the list. Drinking water, same way. No matter how small the project is, you got to get permission from the Department of Health to make those improvements. And I think all the cities are pretty much know that. And if they can contact those agencies, they're all aware. So,
Senator Rummel,
Madam Chair, well, maybe the legislators and senators do need some kind of a little guidance on when because these senators are coming to me left and right, and I'm saying I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know who to send you to. So I would appreciate at least some help in understanding where they should go and who they, you know, because they're telling me they're getting local people coming to them wanting to do something to access these dollars, and they apparently don't know how to do it. So that would be helpful.
Senator Frederickson.
Senator Senator Rummel, I think for these programs, if you talk to Department of Health, PCA, and PFA, you'd get pretty definitive answers. But the Federal Stimulus Act passed so quickly, and the rules weren't promulgated, the decisions weren't made at how they're going to be distributed. Some of those programs, I think they're just rolling out those that level of detail now. Our Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy has been meeting about every week, getting an update on where those regulation and rules are. And a week ago, the Commissioner of Management and Budget was in Washington with others to get more details on how these monies would be spent. You know, several of the agencies have contact persons also to, as they get information, to try and be able to provide it. But in some cases, the information just hasn't been arriving from Washington yet.
Senator Saxhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But, you know, I think Mr. Coleman's a little tough on himself because the lists that they've been accumulating over the years and the fact that he can just go down from what number to what number, 45 to 35 or?
Yes.
In projects. Senator Rummel, I think most of your cities have access to that information too. And I agree that there's new programs coming out all the time, so one is kind of gets confused. But I mean, I think we have a pretty good system.
Chair, are you ready for a motion?
Well, Senator Frederickson, I just would like an answer about what to do with folks who come forward with proposals that could be eligible for some of these funds. What should we do with them? Should we pass another bill that includes all their great ideas and send it on to your agency, Mr. Coleman? Or what is there a better process that you would recommend to make sure that they get the information they need to be considered?
That's the question.
Madam Chair, you could have every one of those cities call my office, PCA or health, any of us, Drinking Water Health or us. Literally, my staff have been spending about 6 hours a day responding to questions. I think there's an assumption out there that there's a lot of grant money. And when you look at it, you know, we have $40 million worth of grants, and we're going to be doing about $550 million worth of construction this year. It's not a lot of money. And the reason that interest has sparked is because they assume it's going to be 100% grant money. So there's a lot of interest on the part of people that really don't have projects yet, or concrete projects. They know they're going to have to do something with their drinking water system. They know they're going to have to do something with their wastewater system, but they haven't hired an engineer. If they did, they haven't really gotten into what really needs to be done to do it. And there's always the case of there's a perception in the municipalities part out there in outstate is the way to get money is to get a bill introduced and hope to get 100% grant, because every once in a while projects do get funded. They usually have a very good story behind them or a unique case, because it is an exception for an individual project to get funded. It does happen in the bonding bills, but not very often. So there's a lot of those things, and I've worked with one city in particular, I won't mention it, but they've been submitting bills to get a wastewater treatment plant for about 5 years running, and they keep telling us, well, they really don't want a loan, they want a grant, and the way to get that is, the only way to get it, the only one to do it would be the legislature appropriating grants, and they don't do that very often, and if they do, it's not for 100% of the project cost. So
all right.
That's different.
Thank you very much, Mr. Coleman. Senator Frederickson moves that Senate File 1329 be recommended to pass, referred to the full Finance Committee. Any further discussion on the bill? Would anyone else like to be heard? Hearing no further discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Chair members, thank you.
We're going to take... Yeah, I think we're going to defer Senator Saxhog's bill to Thursday. Sorry about that for those of you who have been waiting. We'll bring Senator Prettner-Solin up and try to get her bill completed. And we got a little bogged down today, but we had a long list, too. So, Senator Prettner-Solin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. And I hope this should go very, very quickly for you. Senate File 444 gives the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency rulemaking authority to create a statewide greenhouse gas emission registry. This bill is supported by the environmental community, the Chamber of Commerce, and the PCA. It is a priority for the administration and was included in the governor's budget request. To achieve the carbon reduction goals of the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007, we as policymakers need accurate measurements that detail statewide trends in greenhouse gas emissions. This information is critical in making informed policy decisions to reduce emissions and monitor the impacts of these MCAG initiatives that we have legislated.
Okay.
This legislation originally was recommended by the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group and received unanimous consent. The greenhouse gas registry that we are requiring the PCA to establish and maintain will enable recording of greenhouse gas emissions in a central repository that will help us identify strategies for mitigating emissions. This is a simple bill, but it is a crucial step in monitoring our state's progress in achieving its goals under the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007. Currently, a number of entities in Minnesota report emissions to the Climate Registry, including the MPCA, the Met Council, the DNR, and several utility companies. This bill instructs the MPCA to establish a system for reporting and maintaining information to help us develop strategies to achieve the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals. And PCA Manager of Environmental Data Management, Frank Kolosch, is here to speak in support of the bill.
No, that's different. Well, maybe it is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Frank Kolosch.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
I am manager of the Air Assessment and Environmental Data Management section at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The bill that is in front of you, as described, does establish authority for the Pollution Control Agency to conduct rulemaking to implement a greenhouse gas emission inventory. This is in line with the direction that the agency has been heading. We have been waiting for the federal government to pass or propose their mandatory greenhouse gas reporting bill at a federal level. They did that on March the 10th. We are going through that rather long rule. So this bill clarifies the authority of the Pollution Control Agency to conduct this rulemaking and allows us to supplement the federal mandatory rule with data collection processes that will ensure that we can continue to report on the state statutory greenhouse gas emission reporting requirements already in statute.
And Madam Chair, I realize that there is a small fiscal note on this. It has been included in the governor's recommendation. I realize that you haven't put your budget together yet. If there's any possibility of letting this bill transfer or pass out of committee and travel on its own, I would appreciate it.
Well, Senator Prettner-Solin, I talked to our staff about that. It would be a little unusual because it does have a fiscal cost to it, and we have to account for this in the budget, which, as you mentioned, we haven't done yet. So if you went onto the Finance Committee, they would want to know where the money's coming from. Why does it matter? I mean, I understand it's your bill, and you want to pass your bill separately, but I think that would be a little strange.
Yeah, Madam Chair, they've made some changes in the other body that I would like to control a little bit more.
Oh, you're worried about the language that's in there?
Yes.
Well, we can certainly let you work out the language differences with the other body, even if it's in the budget bill. I'd be happy to work with you on that.
Okay.
I just think it makes more sense, and this is our regular practice. If it has, I mean, it's not a long policy bill. It's really just a bill that tells the agency to do this, and so it really makes sense to keep it in our budget bill. But I'm happy to let you take the lead in working out the details of how it works, as long as that conforms with our budget needs.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think we can make that work. Senator Pariseau?
Madam Chair, my question is to Mr. Kolosch, and it has to do with how will the agency manage this system? I'm looking at the language that lies between lines 116 through 20 or so, because with coordination may without limitation use similar forms, blah, 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 blah. The sharing of information, use of common facilities, reporting need not include all sources nor all amounts. How can you manage that without too much error or omission? It sounds like there are several sources from which to gather information. I'm not sure what they all are.
Mr. Kolosch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pariseau, the language dealing with our coordination with other reporting registries was put in there and a relatively vague term because there are a number of other efforts going on, the Climate Registry being one of those efforts, the Western Climate Initiative being another effort, the Minnesota Governors Association being another effort, and then also at that the point of the at the time of the writing of the bill that we still did not have a federal mandatory reporting bill, but we or rule, but we were expecting that. That was required of them in their appropriations language for fiscal year 2009 at the federal level. So that language, I don't believe, restricts us in any way, and we have been active participants in many of these regional or national initiatives, especially with the Climate Registry. Our Assistant Commissioner David Thornton is on the board of the Climate Registry, and he's been involved in the development of the reporting protocols for the Climate Registry, including our staff. And we've been involved on a number of the conference calls and the model rule developments for the Western Climate Initiative and the other, all of the other initiatives. So what this, we don't see that that language restricts us or presents an insurmountable challenge to us. What it allows us to do is to use what has been learned by these other registries and reporting rules, and in order to make the reporting efficient and avoid double counting and avoid double reporting, allows us to use what resources have been developed to this date to develop our own emission inventory rule.
And Madam Chair, as a follow-up, as I look at the back page, it talks about the rulemaking. So is that something that may have started already, or it extends from past rulemaking?
Mr. Golesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
How long might it take before you can get started on the actual gathering?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Parris, so we have not started that rulemaking at this time, but we have anticipated that a state-level rulemaking would be necessary, and that's based on our experience of our other emissions inventories that we operate in the agency. We had deferred from starting any rulemaking because, again, we were anticipating a federal mandatory rulemaking rule to come out, and we did not want to be overly duplicative or in conflict with what the federal government was requiring of us. And since that has come out, we are participating on the conference calls. We are preparing our comments on the rule and attempting to work with EPA to understand the comprehensive nature and whether or not we would, and we at this point we believe we would need to supplement the federal rule with a state rule to allow us to ensure that we can continue to report on the state statutes for emissions reductions that we have in front of us. But we anticipate that within the next biennium, by the end of the next biennium, we would have started rulemaking for this once we understand what the final federal rule is going to be, how the federal government is going to implement that rule, and what they're going to require of us, and what we would need to add to supplement to that federal mandatory rule.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Is there further discussion on the bill? Would someone like to make a motion? Senator Fredrickson moves that Senate File 444 be recommended for inclusion in the omnibus budget bill and laid on the table. On that motion, any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
And members, Senator Saxhog's bill will be laid over for Thursday. We can add it to the agenda, correct? All right. With that, the committee's adjourned.